It's hard for me to believe that I have gotten more than 3/4 of a year into the run of this podcast without telling my Chuck Knoblauch story. If you want to get a sense of whether you would have the patience to live with me or not, it really depends on your tolerance for the Chuck Knoblauch story. I mean, about once a week I turn to my wife and say, "Did I ever tell you the Chuck Knoblauch story?" "Yes, you told me the Chuck Knoblauch story." I turn to my kids. "Did I tell you the Chuck Knoblauch story?" "Yes, Dad." "When did I tell you the Chuck Knoblauch story?" "At breakfast, Dad." "Well, that was a long time ago." "That was 10 minutes ago, Dad." Not to build it up too much, but this is one of my favorite interactions with a player in the entire time that I've written about baseball. And most of my career is not about doing on-site reporting. I've mostly been a commentator, a columnist, and I enjoy doing that. And I enjoy talking to the players too, but that hasn't been a focus. I have never pretended to be a journalist in the sense of being someone who has a day-to-day presence on the field. Nevertheless, if the opportunity presents itself and there's a good reason, I will get over my anxieties and my reluctance to dress nicely and we'll head out to the ballpark. And this was one of those occasions. Somewhere about 1999, I was writing for Yankees Magazine and had occasion to do an interview with Knoblauch. For those who came into baseball later than 2002, Knoblauch was a second baseman, the 1991 Rookie of the Year with the Minnesota Twins, and then made the All-Star team about four times, even won a Gold Glove. He was a mostly speed-based player, not a ton of home run power, although keep in mind that the ball was not flying out back then the way it is now. But at his peak, which came in 1995 and 1996, he hit .333 and .341 respectively, took 78 walks one year, 98 the next, led the league with 14 triples, stole 46 and 45 bases. He was a very, very good player. And the Yankees, who didn't really have a regular second baseman, coveted him. In February 1998, they sent four players, Brian Buchanan, Christian Guzman, Eric Milton, Danny Mota, and Cash, to the Twins, who were literally looking to go out of business at that point. Fire sale doesn't quite do it justice. They were actively petitioning the commissioner to contract them. That's how much their ownership loved baseball. And although he pretty much instantly, at 29, 30, 31, was not the same player he had been with the Twins, he was still a contributor to their 98, 99, and 2000 World Series champions. The only problem was that in 1999, he developed one of those psychoses that second basemen are sometimes afflicted with that go back to Steve Sachs and a couple of other players, namely that he couldn't throw to first base on a 4-3 ground out. This is kind of a problem for a second baseman, as you might imagine. Ultimately, the Yankees' solution was to move him to left field, but that wasn't an effective choice because his bat had decayed to the point that it was no longer great for a second baseman, never mind for a corner outfielder. But while he was still at second base and in the midst of all this drama, I had this chance to talk to him alone in the Yankees clubhouse. I towered over Chuck Knoblauch. I don't usually have that experience with players. I am 6'1 if I really unkink my spine and maybe somebody put me in the dungeon and racked me that morning. Even so, players like Derek Jeter, Roger Clemens, I would look up at them and pray that Roger Clemens did not say, "Pound me from a great height with his mighty fists." That's how small I felt. And if you meet me, there's really not a lot that's small stature-wise about me. But television really reduces these guys somehow, and sitting in the stands doesn't do them justice either. If you're standing next to them, you realize what a top-flight athletic specimen who's above the height and weight curve really looks like. Knoblauch is officially listed at 5'9", but I think he squeezed in a couple of extra inches on that because he was at least a full head shorter than me. In the midst of talking to him about what he was going through, and he was very open about it, I said, "Willie Randolph is a coach on this team. He was a great defensive second baseman. He's been through the pressure of playing in New York, having been here since 1976. He's been singled out for criticism by George Steinbrenner. Every possible permutation of tension that you could experience here in New York, he's probably experienced. So have you talked to him about what you're going through?" And Knoblauch's eyes sort of crossed. I don't mean like in a cartoony way, but he had this confused look on his face. And he looked up at me and he said, as if he had never thought of it before, "No, no, I haven't." "You You'd think that would be obvious, wouldn't you? I just sort of shrugged or nodded, I'm not sure which. And he said, sometimes you don't do the thing that you'd think would be obvious to do. And I said, well, now that you've thought of it, are you going to talk to him? And he said, yeah. I don't remember very much else about the conversation. I'm sure I wrote it up somewhere. What I do remember is that after I emerged from the interview, I ran into my editor and I relayed the conversation and she said, that's it, you fixed him. But no such luck. She was premature. As I said, he wound up in left field. So I don't know whether he talked to Willie Randolph or not, and maybe he did and Randolph had nothing to offer, or the problems were so deeply set that Randolph could have gone all Obi-Wan Kenobi on him and still not made an impact on things. Well, Knobloch's bat was dying as fast as his glove, and his career was soon over. He was done at 33, and we're going on the 16th anniversary season now of his departure from the major leagues. It's been a long time. But ever since then, whenever somebody states something that's tautological or seems to stumble past the very exit from their troubles that they're looking for, those words come back to me. Now, last week, on the occasion of the massacre in Florida, I told you a story about a gun death in the Polo Grounds in 1950. And one of the reasons that story seemed apt was that, sure, it was random. A bullet fired in the air just happened to hit this guy. But it also couldn't have happened if there were not guns, an excess of guns, a surfeit of guns, a glut of guns, even then scattered loosely about the country. Since then, one of the proffered solutions by the people on the pro-gun side, including the president, is to suggest that all or a select group of teachers be armed so as to be able to return fire when some miscreant, for lack of a better term, I'm reminded of George Harrison referring to John Lennon's assassin as the devil's best friend in the song All Those Years Ago, appears on the doorstep of the House of Education determined to do bloody murder. And it strikes me that whenever we are confronted by one of these situations, that we have, to greatly simplify things, a couple of solution sets, almost like a recipe. One is to subtract guns and one is to add them. Now, I am a very poor and unmotivated chef indeed, but nevertheless, this reminds me of two orangutans trying to make a dish of chicken franchise for the first time. Imagine two of them, Chet and Bob. Chet is cooking, Bob is supervising. You always need a supervisory orangutan. Human bureaucracy, our greatest invention, has proved that. Have you ever had chicken franchise? It's chicken breast, which is dipped in an egg batter and then cooked in a pan in a lemon butter sauce. And I've found that, as an avid consumer of chicken franchise, that it is somewhat difficult for the chef to get the amount of lemon right. If you don't have enough lemon, it doesn't taste like anything at all. It just tastes like some plain chicken cooked in a pan. And of course, I suppose you could go in the other direction as well. And so I imagine Bob saying to Chet, you know, I've sampled this, and it's somewhat lemony, but not lemony enough, perhaps. And so Bob says, well, Chet, add more lemon. So they squeeze out another lemon on the chicken franchise, let it cook a little more, and sample it again. Well, now it's too lemony. Solution? Add more lemon. So they squeeze out a couple more lemons onto the franchise. Chet samples it again and says, Bob, now it's so tart as to be inedible, and I think we got kind of the pith in there, so it's both sour and bitter. I really don't know how we salvage the dish at this point. And Bob says, are you stupid or something? The answer's obvious. Add more lemon. And they go on and on this way, not realizing that at no point will you add so much lemon that you wrap around somehow on the cosmic lemon scale and reach some kind of lemon neutral again. The only real choice is to start over and use less lemon. Not just in this specific dish created by Chet and Bob, not just in schools, but everywhere. So when we have a proposal that is meant to respond to an overabundance of gunplay with more gunplay, and someone politely points out, perhaps Chet and Bob, orangutan commentators, more guns just lead to more death, not less. I find Chuck Knobloch popping up like a ghost, saying, You'd think that would be obvious, wouldn't you? I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. Why did the sauropods have long necks? Oh, my children, what a wonderful question, said the ancient sage Orge. Once the sauropods had short necks as we do, but one day Timmy, the most innocent and naive of them all, looked up at the sky and saw a distant glimmer of light. He showed it to his friends, and they saw it too. What is it? They asked. It is the light of God's love, said Timmy. We must crane our necks so that we may see it better. So every night they stretched and they stretched and they stretched, and their necks grew longer and longer. And indeed, as they did, they could see the light more clearly. It's coming closer, Timmy said. We must work harder. And so they stretched and they stretched, and their necks grew and grew until they were the longest necks that had ever been seen in all of nature. And one beautiful, glorious night, they gazed at the sky, stretching their necks as far as they would go, and they could see within the light a glorious sphere wrought with fine metals, gold and platinum, cerium, europium, yttrium, scandium, promethium. Timmy was rapturous. It's beautiful, Timmy said. Even in the few minutes that they were looking at it, they could see it moving rapidly closer. The God of the sauropods is rewarding us for our devotion. God is sending his love to us. All we have to do is remain here, right in this spot, and we will soon be kissed by God's love. And my children, he was right, for there is now a huge crater in Mexico marking the spot where Timmy stood. And that is why the sauropods had long necks, and also why no man has ever seen a sauropod. Their theology was inconsistent with episode 43. Just ask any paleontologist. It's all true. Welcome back to the show. I'd like to carry on with the theme of, you'd think that would be obvious, wouldn't it? But this time with a slightly different twist, a less current events twist, that was inspired to some extent by today's guest, Rachel McDaniel. Rachel writes for Baseball Prospectus, and she tends to write in a fairly dark manner. You'll hear us discuss this extensively. She will write about current events pertaining to the team she is tasked to cover, the Blue Jays, but she also does a lot of ruminative pieces, often written in the second person, that express her very turbulent inner emotional life through baseball. And those pieces, while not without humor or creativity or uplift, can be challenging because, as with her terrific piece on Doug Ault, the expansion-era Blue Jays first baseman who took his own life, they are written from the perspective of someone who understands those kinds of black emotions from the inside out. In that piece, which I urge you to read, it's at the Baseball Prospectus Toronto Local, she wrote, "There is a really strange thing that the public does when they think about suicide victims. I think it's a kind of lack of understanding of what life is like when you feel like the only right choice is to stop being alive. People act like there was a time when it was easy, and then all of a sudden it was hard, too hard to handle, sliding from the top of the mountain to the bottom until you hit the ground, thud, the end. How tragic. People don't realize that the tragedy of suicide is not a tragedy of descent. The ending is tragic, but the life is not. The life, however long it was, is a shining document of victory." you're not going to get that sort of insight, that sort of emotional exploration from a lot of baseball writers, in part because I bet you didn't know you were looking for it. Well, now you know. And don't worry if you're only looking for the kind of baseball coverage that formulaically rehearses whether player A was signed for this many dollars per war and player B was traded for a projectable prospect. Well, unlike the sauropods, those folks and those pieces are in no danger of going extinct. As always, being honest with you, I really didn't know what to expect. I'd never spoken to her before. I read all her pieces, so I had some understanding of her personal history to the extent that she's written about it and her mindset, but I didn't know what talking to her would be like. And I was pleasantly surprised that the public Rachel is not the same as the inner Rachel, the Rachel whose voice dominates those pieces. The public Rachel is a much more bubbly and outgoing personality. And that was great. I really enjoyed talking to her. But I also had this awareness that, given what she's written right up to the present day, there is another lower level. There's a basement somewhere down below the top floor where some other things are churning around. And that dichotomy put me in mind of this overlapping story of baseball and art, overlapping because they both took place in 1936. I want to begin by playing you a song that the world first heard on April 11th, 1936, 3 days before the start of the regular season. This version is from Frank Sinatra's 1955 concept album, In the Wee Small Hours of the Morning. The song is called Glad to Be Unhappy.
Look at yourself. If you had a sense of humor, you would laugh to beat the band. And look at yourself. Do you still believe the rumor that romance is simply grand? Since you took it right on the chin, you have lost that bright toothpaste grin. My mental state is all a jumble. I sit around and sadly mumble. Fools rush in, so here I am. Very glad to be unhappy. I can't win, but here I am. More than glad to be unhappy. Unrequited love's a bore, and I've got it pretty bad. But for someone you adore, it's a pleasure to be sad, like a straying baby lamb, with no mammy and no pappy. I'm so unhappy, but oh, so glad.
The song was not an instant hit, but it nevertheless caused a great deal of stupidity over the years, and this is because of who wrote it. The composer was Richard Rodgers, later more famous for Oklahoma and South Pacific and scores like that, and the lyrics were by his original partner, Lawrence Hart, typically called Larry. Larry Hart was a complicated individual. He was, simultaneously, very smart, very funny, very lovable, very frustrating, very drunk, and very depressed. To that list, we have to add one more very, very short. He was under 5 feet tall, and at the risk of vastly oversimplifying Larry Hart, his height influenced a lot of other things about his life. He was so small as an adult that until Rogers and Hart became so successful that Larry could afford bespoke clothing, he had to shop in the kids' department at Macy's. That cannot do much for an adult's self-esteem. If you see pictures of him, he always has a huge Cuban cigar in his mouth, and he's so small that it's not clear who's smoking who. But what if you are a grown man with a grown man's libido and desires, physical and emotional, but you have the body of a doll? Larry was a closeted homosexual. He was born in 1895, and this is not something you could be out about, even in the Broadway demimonde of those days. And that was undoubtedly difficult and torturous by itself, but Hart's biographers always struggle with a kind of chicken and egg question when it comes to his sexuality. They don't know if he came by his preference for same-sex relationships because that's just the way he was born, that's just the way he was wired, or because, given his stature, men were the only ones who would take him seriously. Women, or at least the women that he expressed an interest in, did not take him seriously as a potential romantic or life partner because he was not a traditional specimen of masculinity. And it may be, as with so many people, there was a little of both mixed in there, but that because he had this terrible self-image, this dysmorphia, about his stature, that he felt shoehorned into the one category. I don't really know. No one will ever know. As with many great artists, he was able to channel what he was experiencing into a wide variety of songs, but particularly, he became what the critic Will Friedwald has called the poet laureate of romantic dysfunction. His lyrics express a lot of ambivalence about relationships. The song I just played you is called Glad to Be Unhappy, but it's fair to say that, although there's no particular song by this title in his catalog, his characters are also unhappy to be glad. One of my favorite cynical lyrics by him is a song, also from the 30s, called I Wish I Were in Love Again, and it contains the lines, the furtive sigh, the blackened eye, the words, I'll love you till the day I die, the self-deception that believes the lie, I wish I were in love again. Meanwhile, over in Brooklyn, the right-handed pitcher Van Lingle Mungo didn't want to be in love again. He was married and had some women on the side, too. He just wanted some run support and some good fielding. The Dodgers were literally bankrupt and in full fire sale mode, had dealt off their all-star second baseman and their all-star catcher for not much in the previous offseason, and Mungo was taking it kind of personally, especially because he had been the best player on the Dodgers, on a war basis too, going back to 1933. He was one of the hardest throwing pitchers in the National League, if not the hardest throwing. And although his command was not always equivalent to his stuff, he was, on the whole, very good. 2.72 ERA in 1933, 3.37 in 1934, 3.65 in 1935. These are all better than league average figures, compiled in a very small ballpark. Nevertheless, in an age in which win-loss record was everything for evaluating pitchers, he tended to hover around 500 because the ball club around him was not very good. And in 1935, he had gotten through May with an ERA of 2.76, but his record was only 6-6 due to a lack of run support. On June 5th, it started to come apart for him, though. In a start at Chicago, there were three errors behind him, one of which was his own, although I suspect that he thought it should be charged to the team's rookie first baseman, Buddy Hassett, who failed to pick up his throw on a bunt play. But what probably troubled him more was the error made by the shortstop Lonnie Frey, who one day would be a great second baseman, but at this time the Dodgers were pushing to play short. He had a great bat for short, but he also had a 50-error glove there. With all that going on, Mungo seems to have lost his concentration, and in the fifth inning he was charged with 7 runs and lost. In his next start, on June 9th at Pittsburgh, Frey made another error behind him, and Mungo seems to have lost it. He walked 6 in an inning and a third, also gave up 4 hits, 6 runs scored, and he got hooked. And at that point, he said, screw you, called all his teammates no better than semi-pro, and jumped the club. Drinking a fair amount, as he was prone to, he told his manager, Casey Stengel, I've been the sap for this outfit long enough. I've carried this club on my shoulders for years with nothing but lousy support and have to make my own hits to win the ones I do. I want to be traded. He had at least something of a point because Stengel had taught him to go the other way instead of trying to pull the ball, and he became a pretty good hitter for a pitcher. Either way, Stengel told him to go ahead and leave, that he could lose with or without him. And he didn't even know the half of it. This was happening in the midst of a 9-game losing streak. And the Dodgers would be an awesome 4-21 in June overall. Now, to be fair, a sports writer, seeing that there might be a story in all this, took it upon himself to pay Mungo's train fare out of town. That seems kind of ethically sketchy, creating the story. It's up there with the famous telegram from William Randolph Hearst to his correspondent in Cuba, you furnish the pictures, I'll furnish the war. But in any case, Mungo was gone. He went off to Brooklyn to see the team's owner, got something between a pat on the head and a kick in the ass, and was fined a few $100s, and sent off to rejoin the team on the road in Cincinnati. But he was still angry. He said he wouldn't pay the fine and demanded to be traded. This is one of those bitter ironies because, a couple of days before all this happened, Casey Stengel was speculating that the club could rejuvenate itself by trading Mungo to the Giants for Mel Ott and Hank Lieber, which is kind of like saying that you could trade him to the Diamondbacks for Paul Goldschmidt and A.J. Pollock at ages 27 and 25, respectively. It was just pure speculation, and today would be tampering. But in any case, once he jumped the club, all the other teams were on record as saying they had no interest in a malcontent. For example, over in St. Louis, Branch Rickey had made some trade bids for Mungo, but he said, I don't want him now. I wouldn't claim him at the waiver price. Not a man who quits like that. Mungo stayed in Brooklyn that year. He finished with an 18-19 record and a well below average 3.35 ERA in 37 starts, 45 games. He saved 3. But the Dodgers, who were in a paralyzed position front office-wise, didn't move him, and in the 1937 All-Star Game, which was his 4th All-Star Game, he hurt his arm. It was the same All-Star Game that Dizzy Dean hurt his arm. The All-Star Game is really a bloody menace. And by the time the Dodgers did let him go, all the way in the future in 1941, he was just a shell of himself. A bitter, carousing, canoodling shell of himself. And he would go back to his home state of South Carolina and get involved in various businesses, and none of them would really do well. He did have a glimmer of hope that he might make some money because another great songwriter, Dave Frischberg, decided to use his name in a song.
Heaney Majeski, Johnny G, Eddie Juiced, Johnny Pesky, Thornton Lee. Danny Gardella, Van Lingle, Mungo, Whitey Karowski.
That was 1969. It had to be explained to Mungo that Frischberg didn't have to pay him any royalties to sing his name over some nice notes. That's what we have of Mungo, the song, and a lot of stories of trashed hotel rooms, drunken fights, and being spirited out of Cuba just ahead of a jealous husband, but what we don't have are a lot of tales of success, and it doesn't seem like he enjoyed his major league career all that much. At least, though, he lived to a good old age. Larry Hart became a slow-motion suicide. The more success he and Dick Rogers had, the more he didn't want to work, and the more he drank, to the point that he quickly transited from being a functional alcoholic to a non-functioning alcoholic. In 1943, he went on an epic bender during a rainstorm and was found insensate in the street. He had contracted double pneumonia, and shortly thereafter, he died. He was 48 years old. According to the book Lorenz Hart, A Poet on Broadway, by Frederick Nolan, his last words might have been, "What did I live for?" Glad to be unhappy has long been considered his most autobiographical song. To put it politely, this is spectacularly wishful thinking. In the same book I just referenced, the author says, "I once asked Richard Rogers if Larry was glad to be unhappy. He most emphatically was not," he replied forcefully. "In fact, he was very unhappy about it." I first read that book some years ago, and when I try to remember Rogers' response, what I usually come up with is, "What do you think?" Or some other variant on, "Are you really going to ask me a question that stupid?" Sometimes poetry is poetry, a song is a song, and a life is a life, and you can invent every kind of metaphor for your pain, every kind of analogy, but it doesn't obviate the pain. And it takes great naivete to look at a man who drank himself to death and say, "Well, he said he was glad to be unhappy, so he must have been, right?" Conversely, at roughly the same moment the song was first being performed on Broadway, Van Mungo's career was going to hell over in Brooklyn, and yet no one would have had the temerity to say to him, "But you're enjoying it, right? All the losing? Those 51 errors by your shortstop, they're a laugh riot, right?" That's because Mungo put out the right signals. Larry Hart didn't exactly, or maybe he did, but at that time, in that place, the people around him weren't capable of recognizing them and responding appropriately. Today we know better. No one is glad to be unhappy. And you do them a disservice if you mistake their creativity for anything more than a momentary escape. In fact, it might not be an escape at all. We'll take a break for a word from our sponsors, and then I'll be back with Rachel McDaniel. My next guest is someone I've really been looking forward to talking to, a far superior talent scout than I. One of this show's patrons, Ben Lindbergh, recommended I talk to this person, and he was right, because when I read her work, I was just blown away by the different ways that baseball becomes everything. Baseball becomes a way of painting different moods, and it's not just all about stats. She is a student at the University of British Columbia, but more importantly, she's also a writer at Baseball Perspectives. She is Rachel McDaniel. How are you, Rachel?
I am doing very well, thank you.
I'm so glad that you're here. The first question I want to ask you, and I don't want to make a big deal of this, I'm reminded of Ronald Reagan when he was running for president the second time at like 80, and Walter Mondale was like 60, and Reagan joked that he would not make his opponent's age an issue in the campaign. I don't want to like spend the whole show talking about how old I am and how young and precocious you are, but when I was your age, I too was in college and thinking about writing, but I certainly didn't jump right to one of the most prestigious baseball journals that exist, Baseball Prospectus. There was no Baseball Prospectus. There was practically no online, so the parameters were a little different. But still, how did that come about?
Basically, what happened was I was clicking around reading my Blue Jays news pretty much exactly a year ago, actually. And I looked at the Baseball Prospectus Toronto local site, which before that point I hadn't actually known existed. And the first post on the site was, "Oh, we're looking for writers." And I had been reading baseball writing for about a year at that point. And the more I read, the more I figured, hey, this could be something that I wanted to do. But I didn't really think it was a realistic expectation to ever be able to do that, you know, with any kind of platform. So I saw this post. I figured, what the hell? I might as well just send some writing in. I'd never written anything about baseball before. So I whipped something up in about an hour and I sent it in. And then a few weeks later, I got the email back saying, hey, we'd love you to write for us. And so that's where it all started. Exactly a year ago, actually. So this is very fortuitously timed.
Well, glad to be here to help celebrate your first anniversary. So what gave you the confidence to jump in when, and again, I'm not trying to say there are any prerequisites for this course exactly. Like, everybody's a little different and everybody brings something a little different, but the writer toolkit comes with a lot of insecurity, I think, and a lot of inauthenticity syndrome where your brain is telling you, like, I can't do this. But you seem to have gotten right past that. So how did you know you could do this?
I didn't. I was actually terrified when I got the email back saying, oh, yeah, sure, come write for us. Because I was like, this was a terrible idea. I am going to get laughed off the internet. Or even worse, nobody is going to read anything I write. And then this is going to be like a 3-month experiment. And I will fade away back into my normal life of being a student getting a useless degree and also working in retail. So I really just did not feel very confident at all. But I also didn't feel like, I felt like if I was going to get the opportunity to do this, I might as well do whatever I wanted and not try to like write something that was more of the standard, you know, blog kind of stuff that I saw a lot of. Because I felt somewhere inside me, buried beneath the insecurity, that I had a unique perspective that people would want to read. And I could say things that I didn't see other people saying. But it was just, that was buried under several layers of, oh God, I can't do this. Oh God, help me, help, help.
But you did it. And as I said, as you just said, it is an unusual point of view. And I admire the fact, both on your part and on the current BP editorship's part, to understand that baseball can be everything. It doesn't just have to be, to mix my metaphors with football, the X's and O's. It doesn't have to be stats and closely analyzing trades and all that stuff. And I'm not saying you can't do that. And you have commented on different things that were current events wise happening with the Blue Jays, but you're more interested, I think, in exploring kind of what you're going through versus through the lens of what your team is going through and vice versa. So how has the reaction to that been?
I've really been overwhelmed by how positive the reaction was, actually, because this whole time, basically for the first few months that I was writing, I genuinely figured that nobody was reading anything. And so I felt pretty safe to just write whatever I wanted because I was like, eh, nobody's reading this anyway. So when my editor, Josh at BP Toronto, like we met up in real life in September and he told me the numbers on the number of people reading my stuff, I had a horrifying moment of, oh man, what have I been doing? But I don't really see myself, I couldn't have gotten to this point if I had not written the way that I write. And I'm also just absolutely not interested in it because, like, I love statistics and sabermetrics. And that was part of the reason why I got really into baseball. Like, Effectively Wild actually was just a huge thing for me, learning about statistics. But I see so many people doing that already. Like, I don't really feel that I have the level of mathematical knowledge to say anything really exciting or new, but I can say things that are exciting or new coming from my own, like, very specific perspective because nobody knows me except me. So that's basically just what I'm interested in doing, and I'm glad that people have enjoyed reading it so far.
I mean, that's one thing that I've never quite understood, and even when I was at BP, there was pushback both internally and sometimes externally when we would try to vary things up a little bit. And I've never understood that. I've never understood anybody saying stick to sports or derogating pieces that aren't, as I said, strictly sabermetric, because Lord knows there's enough of that if you want to look for it. And most of it at this stage is duplicative of other pieces in the same vein, because there's only so many ways to say that, say, you know, the Blue Jays outfield production is weak or that the rotation isn't that deep. You can say it. And if you're deeply a Blue Jays fan or any other team for that matter, you can say that. But as you said, not everybody can or every piece can make you think in a deeper or more existential way about something that connects to what's happening on the field but has a more universal application.
Yeah, I mean, that was my problem with the glut of statistical writing online, is that everybody leaps to cover a transaction, obviously, while it's current so that you get those clicks. But there's only so many reasonable opinions you can have on any given event in baseball. Otherwise, you're just going off into the realm of pure speculation and just writing something because you had to write something, like something totally zany. And I absolutely am not interested in just taking the same reasonable opinion on any given trade, or the Blue Jays had like their left field production is in the pits, because everybody knows that and other people have already written about it, and I don't care anymore.
Some of the material that you write about can be fairly dark, and I was hoping that you would be willing to read a piece that you wrote. This is the first one, actually, just by happenstance. I've now read pretty much everything you've written, but this was the first one that I read, and it was the one that really impressed me. And there are many as good, but you know, you never forget your first love, I guess. So I was wondering if you would read The Box.
Yeah, sure. I am in a box. As far as I know, I was born in this box, and I will die in this box. I've never seen anything outside the box. It's just me here. A few inches of room between me and the walls. Sometimes I wonder how I haven't suffocated by now, and then I wonder how it is that I know I should have suffocated by now, given that I don't know anything other than this box. Sometimes I become aware of my own thoughts, which feature concepts like suffocation, and wonder where I got the language to think them from. Occasionally I wonder how I know I'm enclosed, why I seem to have some awareness that there's something outside where I currently am, though nothing I've ever experienced suggests this to be true. These moments of dissonance, never resolved, are the most interesting things that ever happened to me. They're terrifying, and I try to forget them as quickly as possible. At some point, I indulge the thought of being enclosed for a little too long. I decide to try to break the box. I have no real expectation of anything happening. Still, I begin to feel panicky. I shift my arms ever so slightly, and something changes. I can't quite tell what's different at first. My surroundings look the same, feel the same. It takes me a moment to realize that I am hearing something, an overwhelming noise that separates itself gradually into many noises interacting with each other, voices and voices and voices, so close they must be right beside me. I'm surrounded by people. Have I always been surrounded by people? My chest clenches. I try to move more, but I can't. I try to see if I've created some opening that's allowing the sound to get through, some opening I could exploit to escape, but there isn't, and I can't. The voices are all speaking the same specific language, with a lot of words I don't understand and some that I do. I understand hit and throw and run. There are strikeouts, and there are base paths, and there are middle relievers. Everyone around me is so excited for this strange thing that they're talking about, this thing with hitting and throwing and running and all the other words I don't know. It's starting soon. That's the main thing. It's starting soon. Everyone is so glad it's starting soon. I wish I could see this thing everyone's talking about, or even just ask them about it. Some of the voices are very angry or sad, but they all seem so engaged, and they all have so many other voices to talk to. That seems like it must count for something. But there's nothing I can do. I'm still in the box, no better or worse off than before. Around me, the voices are counting down the days.
First of all, I thank you for doing that. And I apologize, in a sense, for asking you to do it, because I was just thinking that were it me having to read one of my pieces as I was reading it, I would be cursing myself and going, why did I put that punctuation there? Why is that word wrong? Like, I don't know if you were doing the same thing. I don't think you have any need to, but I think it's a very natural thing to be doing. And I also want to emphasize, this is an off-season piece. And whereas it's a very personal piece, again, it's very universal, because given just how god awful slow this off-season has been till recently, we've all kind of been in that box, and we can all be happy that it's starting soon when they are forced to do something just by the calendar. So is this piece kind of a metaphorical way of relating not just the thaw of spring that I just referred to, but kind of your own journey into baseball starting a year ago?
Yeah, there's a reason why when I write this kind of weird speculative-ish fiction for short relief, I typically do it in the second person. There's a specific reason why I chose to do this one in first person, because I felt like this was coming very directly from how I was feeling when I was writing it however long ago. Oh, like 2 weeks ago. Wow. Passage of time. It's incredible. But this is coming like really out of the moment, because I write all my short relief pieces basically in a panic, because I spend the whole week not knowing what I'm going to write about. And then it's the day before they have to get published. So this kind of came up organically, because I was feeling this really crushing like numbness just in general to life. And then scrolling through my Twitter feed and seeing everybody, you know, fighting about how the off season was playing out, what was going to happen this season. There was this strange, uncanny feeling that I was like immediately involved in it, but also indelibly like separated from it. So that's the kind of feeling that this came out of. It was kind of very negative, I guess. I try to be more positive at the ends of my pieces, but this one didn't turn out that way.
Well, you're very good at setting up a series of emotions in a lot of these pieces and then kind of undercutting it at the end. And I don't mean that as a criticism. I mean it as kind of throwing a change up. And it may be a change to a brighter or more positive outlook. But the point is that you have to go through the whole journey. You have to go through the whole process. And I think that as with any story that is fictional, however based in true life these are, right? I mean, the protagonist is the person who changes. If you don't have change, you don't have a story. And each of these is a complete story. So you're setting kind of a high bar of difficulty for yourself each time you go out.
Yeah. I just like, I really, really don't want to write something that I'm not proud of. So I basically just like, I go into everything I write, like full intensity. So I'm glad to hear that these come out as full stories, because sometimes I have doubts.
So let me ask you this, and there's no kind of gentle way of saying this. As I alluded to before, and as this story suggests, sometimes these are very dark. And I should say, by the way, this is something I mentioned to you offline. One of the reasons I was so enamored of this is because it almost seemed like a sequel to one of the darkest James Thurber stories. And he's one of those writers who I aspire to, but will never come within 1,000 miles of being like. But he wrote a story called The Box, which is a bit of a longer thing, but about a guy who just kind of wanders around asking people for a box because he needs a box to hide in. So this is almost like what happens after you have the box. Now you have to get out again, or at least you hear the voices of people kind of slowly making their way to camps in Phoenix and Florida. And there's perhaps a reason to get out. But having read through all your stuff, there are allusions to a lot of personal difficulties that you're going through, and you have these stories are your way of maybe dealing with those or exercising to them extent. But what is suggested sometimes directly and sometimes by implication is that you have been to some very dark places, and that baseball was not a part of your life going all the way back to, say, your childhood, but that it's something that you found more recently that has helped you cope with some of what you're going through. So can you talk about kind of where you've been and what that process was of coming to the game and how it's helping you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really quite convenient for me as somebody who's very narratively oriented and prone to wanting to narrativize my own life, that baseball kind of draws this perfect circle in the timeline of my life around the darkest points that I have been through. Like, I loved baseball as a kid. My whole family loves baseball. I grew up watching it. I grew up watching the Blue Jays, who my older brother rooted for, and the Yankees, who my mom rooted for. So that was primarily what I was watching. Didn't really understand a whole lot about why my brother liked the Blue Jays so much, because they were so bad. And I didn't really enjoy watching the sport all that much. I would complain bitterly when I had to go watch my brother play his little league games. What I did enjoy was the physical activity of it. I loved pitching. I loved hitting. I played softball for a while, which was disappointing to me because I would have rather played baseball and I wanted to pitch. So that was me as a kid. Like, it was a big part of my life. And then all of a sudden, around the time when I was like 11 or 12, when you know, you're kind of a preteen, you're hitting puberty, everything's all weird. I did start getting very depressed and also for some reason completely abandoned baseball. I don't know exactly how that happened. Like, I wasn't writing much at the time. That was also the point at which I stopped writing for a long time. I have very detailed diaries from my earlier childhood, but at that point, everything kind of ends. And so it was just gone. And I basically, like, from then until the time I was like 17 and a half, completely forgot that everything I ever liked about baseball, or that the fact that I ever enjoyed it at all. Like, if you had asked me when I was like 15 or 16, if baseball had ever been one of my interests, I probably would have said no. Because genuinely for me, I didn't remember. I didn't remember a lot of things at that time because I was in this horribly, horribly dark place basically for the entire time I was in high school. Then I graduated high school in June of 2015. And in the year previous to that, I had spent 6 months out of that year in the hospital for various mental issues, coming to like a point in February of 2015 where I almost died. And so I got out of the hospital in like April of 2015, barely managed to graduate high school, graduated high school. I had registered for university. I'd gotten in. I didn't really want to go. And so I was just there in the summer of 2015, like working my retail job and just feeling kind of bad about myself and lost because I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go from here. I didn't quite feel as bad, but there was a different kind of bad feeling. Like nothing really meant anything. I didn't know where to go. And then one day I came home from work and my younger brother was watching baseball coverage on TV because he was growing up to be a big baseball fan. I think he was like 8 at the time. So he was just starting to really understand the sport and like get into it. And I saw that they were talking about this big trade that happened, that Troy Tulowitzki went to the Blue Jays. And I had loved Tulo back in the day. I really got deeply invested in the Rockies, like Rocktober run. And my mom was happy about that too, because she thought they could beat the Red Sox, but they didn't. And suddenly, like the watching of that coverage of like, oh, Tulo's going to the Blue Jays, just like opened up this box of feelings that I had completely forgotten about. And so I started like asking my 8-year-old brother, like, what is going on in baseball right now? And are the Blue Jays any good right now? And it turned out, of course, that they would be pretty good for that the rest of that season. And so the rest of that season, I just watched them religiously. And it became something that I did during those summer days where I felt very lost. And it became something that got me through like the kind of scary experience of just starting university. And I've never looked back from there. Like, I can't imagine not watching baseball now. But there was a very long period of time where it just was not any part of my life.
Well, was that sometimes as we go through childhood to adulthood, sometimes our tastes just change and we put things away. And some of them we will rediscover later in life and others we may never go back to or even, you know, look back at them as being embarrassingly childish and just sort of leave them on that shelf. Was it that, or was it that because you were in such a difficult place emotionally or chemically or both, that you had just become alienated from many of the things perhaps that brought joy into your life?
I think it's a little bit of both. Like at the point where I was getting older, I kind of conceived of myself as being like this creative person. Like I did a lot of music and obviously I did some of the writing. Like I did a lot of writing for theater while I was in high school. And so basically just on the points of those being my primary interests at the time, I wasn't connecting with anybody who really liked sports at all. Like it's not really cool as an artist to be into sports. So there just wasn't like a lot of opportunity for me to engage with that. And I didn't want to seem uncool. And then also it was just like, watching baseball like in a detailed way. It takes kind of a big time commitment. I didn't really have the energy to commit to anything at that point. I was too busy being sad. So I just don't think I have the mental space for it.
Isn't it interesting how at that age, and I knew many people like this, and I'm not saying you were necessarily like this, but because it sounds like you were actually doing the writing, but I knew so many people who changed their clothes and to what they perceived to be the artist's look, and then kind of walked around saying, I am an artist. But there wasn't really a book or a poem or a song or a painting behind it. They were just an artist. And maybe they took a drama class, maybe not. But they never actually did the stuff that went with justifying the pose.
I mean, I feel a bit like I did some of that myself, because I did a lot of music. Like I was going to go to music school until all this stuff happened. I didn't have time to practice while I was in the hospital, obviously. So my skills kind of took a downturn at a bad time around university applications. But I loved music. Like I still love music. It's a big passion of mine. But I wanted to be like, you know, like a Pitchfork, like cool indie music kind of person. And so I spent all this time listening to so much music I didn't care about at all, and I didn't like it. I didn't think it was good. I just listened to it because, like, oh, everybody on Reddit, Indie Heads, and Moo is saying that this album is so good and you have to listen to it. So I look back on that time with a feeling that I wasted a lot of time doing things that were not helpful or enjoyable to me in any way, because I wanted to seem like a real musician. But I guess it was a valuable experience in that I can look back on that and say, okay, I'm not going to do that again.
Well, I think at that age, we all try on different masks and identities. And some of them, again, they turn out to be things that, okay, that's who we were at that moment or who we were trying to be. And we had to try them on to figure out that that's not who we actually were. And then we move on. So I don't think it's anything to be embarrassed about. I love the way that you talk about some of the stuff you've gone through openly. And I've always tried to also, like you, I shared depression that onset at adolescence, although it really didn't become kind of a crisis thing until I was a lot older. It was like a periodic visitor and then someone who like cohabitated with me periodically. And then as I got more into my 30s, it became kind of an everyday thing that was really impacting my life. So it's not exactly parallel except for kind of when we started. But ever since then, it's something that I deal with, and I try to talk about it as much as I can so that people understand not to feel stigmatized if they have these feelings, that they should seek help as best they can, because it takes away your quality of life and makes you feel like you have to settle for this really low level existence. And some of us, maybe this sounds pretentious, but if we can turn the pain into art, that's great. But not everybody has that outlet. So I guess there's no real question here exactly, except to say that has it been a process to feel comfortable being this open about some of the stuff? And I mean, there are allusions in your work to things that are perhaps even more dire than you've discussed here. And I'm not going to push you to talk about them. They're there for, excuse me, readers to discover on their own if they want to. But has it been something you've had to learn to be kind of that naked about your emotions? And also, do you worry about, say, when you talk about these things, because I do, if I make a joke about my, or not even a joke, a statement about something that, say, happened between me and my parents on this podcast, my parents are still around to listen to that. And I may or may not have a legitimate gripe against my parents in that instance, but I don't necessarily want to hurt them or cause them to feel any discomfort. I sometimes think about those things. It doesn't usually stop me, but I wonder if those kinds of things, if that's been a process for you as well.
Yeah, it's definitely been a process, just because I am not somebody who's inclined to show sadness. I like jokes. I like joking. I'm a very high energy person to talk to. People have sometimes found it hard to believe that I've felt as bad as I have. Because even when I'm talking about it, I don't like to act like it was that big of a deal to me. And throughout my life, for a variety of reasons, I've had to, like, I feel like I've had to compartmentalize myself and isolate parts of myself in a lot of situations. And while that has been necessary for a variety of reasons, it's still painful. And I don't think it's something that's necessarily healthy all the time. And so going into this kind of writing, because baseball is something that is such a big part of my life and gives me so much joy, I feel like this is an area where I do not want to have to compartmentalize in a way that hurts me. And because all of the stuff I write about is stuff that I deal with on a day-to-day basis, like, I don't sit down with the intention of, like, oh, I'm going to write a statement about depression. It's just what's coming out of my brain. Like, I don't feel any other way. Ergo, I am going to write that because I don't want to have to cut parts of myself off anymore.
Speaking of making somebody feel bad, that there is somebody who does listen to the show that I may make feel uncomfortable by this statement, but I'm wondering if people are always tolerant too of that strain of things. And I understand what it's like when you're going to write and you want to paint in the whole crayon box of colors, but emotionally there's only one color that you're feeling, and it's that black one, it's that dark one. And so what comes out can be bleak. And now you're asking people to go with you on a journey that, whereas they might be able to empathize, they may not necessarily be up for that in their own life. They have different ways of keeping the darkness at bay. And I remember, and this is when I think I was exactly your age. So it was a long time ago, but I also wrote music and I wrote with a partner. And at this, one of the first really, really dark depressions of my life, I just wrote a series of lyrics that were endlessly just like, everything is useless and terrible and horrible and pointless. And he said to me, and I don't think he meant ill by this, but he said, couldn't you just write something happy once in a while? And I felt so hurt.
Yeah,
because he couldn't get it, because he wasn't there and in my shoes, and nor should he have been, nor should I have wished for him to be, and nor can somebody understand it unless they've been through that. So I'm just wondering if, as people, whether it's at BP or some of the other places you've written, or even in your personal life, if they are as understanding of kind of what's driving your creativity as optimally they would be.
I've only gotten like 2 mean tweets so far in the past year. So I feel like people in general are pretty empathetic with what I'm trying to say. That may just be because I try not to have it just be crushingly bleak. Like, I don't want to leave people with a sour taste in their mouth, or just like, oh my God, this person is never going to get out of it. They're just like thinking they were stuck in their negativity forever. Like, I do want to have some kind of transformative aspect in most of what I'm doing. Occasionally, as in the box piece, that doesn't come out very strongly.
Okay.
But most of the time, that is what I'm trying to do. Okay. So yeah, I really haven't had any issues with that. I mean, even in real life, like occasionally when you're a 15-year-old and you're hanging out with 15-year-olds and nobody really knows what's going on, people would be insensitive, but that's because they were 15. So I've never really had bad problems with that.
That's good. And as I said, I mean, in a lot of ways, and you won't know this until 5 to 10 years from now, 20 isn't too different from 15 in terms of maturity sometimes. So I in no way fault the person who said what they said to me. I mean, I've found that life is a long process of, boy, I was stupid back then. And you never really get away from that. But I think that's healthy in a way, because the moment that you think you know everything is the moment you stop learning, and then you're in decline.
You got to accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, and latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In Between. You got to spread joy up to the maximum, bring gloom down to the minimum. Have faith,
or pandemonium liable to walk upon the scene. To illustrate my last remark,
Jonah in the whale, Noah in the ark.
What did they do just when everything looked so dark?
Steve here interrupting Johnny Mercer and the Pied Piper's recording of his own composition with Harold Arlen, Accentuate the Positive, a number two single from 1944. Mercer was inspired by a line he heard from a revivalist preacher, and he and Arlen were such pros they hashed out the whole song on a long car ride, or maybe even a short car ride. Nominated for an Academy Award that year, it was introduced by Bing Crosby in the Paramount picture Here Come the Waves, but they didn't win. They lost to Rodgers and Hammerstein's It Might as Well Be Spring. I'll leave whether they were right or wrong up to you, and we'll be right back with more Rachel McDaniel after these words from our sponsors.
I need the negative and latch on.
One of the ways that I felt for you as I was reading your writing, and again, it may be hard to separate sort of the chicken and the egg here in terms of where the emotion is coming from. I found this piece really moving, but you were listening, I think, to a ball game, and somebody said time is limited, and that sent you off again to sort of an existential place of worrying about mortality and whether you were going to achieve anything in your life and different things like that. And it sent me to two disparate places. One, T.S. Eliot, and this sounds really pretentious, but, and I don't know if you're thinking these kinds of things, but I immediately went to The Wasteland, where in the midst of the second section, he has a barkeep repeatedly saying, hurry up, please, it's time, which may possibly be just the bar closing or could be something much more significant and foreshadowy. And I also thought of Casey Stengel, who in the year, I always think of Casey Stengel, but in the year that Satchel Paige was closing for the Indians, he would tell his players to hurry up and get a lead because Satch was warming up, and he would say, Father Time is coming. Hurry up, Father Time is coming. Is it fair though? I felt like, see, I don't know if the Rachel writing that piece is sort of you, Rachel, or an idealized Rachel who is writing for the public, but whichever Rachel it was, I felt like she was being very unfair because, and again, you can't help where your brain goes sometimes, but you are young and you are just beginning things and there you are worrying about the end. I think this is a successful piece in the sense that I really wanted to say, like, hey, calm down. It's going to be all right.
Yeah, I mean, it is unfair. You're absolutely right. That's just it, a lot of that stuff just comes out of these moments where, yeah, you can't help where your brain goes. I think in general, I am aware of that. But I don't know. Sometimes you just can't help feeling that. And I think that's true of anyone at any age, even though it might seem slightly more ridiculous for me at 20, where a lot of people, I'm sure, look back and like, oh, I wish I was 20. The whole world was ahead of me. Whereas, it might be a generational thing even, because I feel like most of my peers have this very bleak outlook on the state of the world. And we feel like everything is crumbling around, like to the ground around us. And that there, it's hard to envision like a future moving forward. So I don't know. I guess that's just the place it's coming from. I don't think that's representative of my general outlook on life.
Well, I really had to interrogate myself in my reaction to that, in the sense that, and possibly you've had this experience, nobody can sound more like an idiot, more like an insensitive jerk than when they're trying to counsel somebody else on depression. I have had people in my life say, like, you can beat this if you just have a stiff upper lip and you thrust out your chest and just determine I'm going to lick this. But this is not like building a barn. The computer that runs you is malfunctioning. It's sending out junk mail. It's sending out bad chemicals. The various medications have side effects that in a lot of ways complicate your life and make things more difficult as they're making them better in other ways. I mean, you laughed because it's funny, but it's also hurtful that someone could not get you to that degree. So as I'm reading some of your pieces, and you're alluding to some of these very difficult things that you've gone through at very young ages, again, there's sort of an urge to comfort this person, but also an empathy that says, I understand that I can't. And so that leaves you, the reader, I mean, in kind of a difficult place.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I do want to leave things in difficult places. I want to provoke that kind of thought. I don't necessarily want to leave anything on a note that is purely one way or another, because the situation is more complicated than that. And life is more complicated than that, to be really trite. So I'm glad to hear that it provokes that kind of thought, because that's what I'm aiming for.
So you're studying at the University of British Columbia. You've written that you're studying playwriting and English lit. Are you at the Vancouver campus?
Yes, I am.
Okay. This is really trivial, but I'm kind of curious about this. I know nothing about Vancouver. Very little. I've been the closest I've been to Vancouver, Seattle, and that was a long time ago. I've been to other parts of Canada. I've been to Montreal and Toronto, but I've never gotten to what looks like a beautiful city. And as I was looking online, preparing to talk to you, I noticed that they have this cool feature in the student center where there's like this mushroom in the middle of it, or a bird's nest or a lounge that's like towering way above the rest of the student center.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you if you'd sat up there, because it looks like a really cool place to write.
I have not spent pretty much any time there, because UBC has something like 54,000 students.
Oh, no.
It's almost impossible to find anywhere to sit on campus during prime hours. You gotta go sit. Most of the time, if I'm sitting at UBC, I'm sitting on a floor in a dark hallway, because that's the only quiet place I can find to sit. The student center is constantly jam-packed. They've got music blasting from these huge speakers. So it's beautiful. Like, at UBC in general is a very beautiful campus. It's just very hectic, and it's not an environment I wish to spend a lot of time in. So I usually end up just going out to a 24-hour cafe and writing at night. It's how I do most of my work.
Oh, that's kind of disappointing, because it looked like a really nice feature. But I know how that is. That kids have a way of staking out the best spots. And that was true when I was in college also, that there would be this great loft in the student center with this huge open fireplace. And just by virtue of the fact that everybody else was always there, I'd be in the pizza place.
Yeah.
So what are your goals in terms of what you're studying now and what you ultimately hope to accomplish when you're done?
The reason why I'm studying creative writing in university is that I'm just not interested in being in large classes. And as an undergrad at this huge school, there's really not any other option. Because even in my upper level English classes that I've done a few of, there are still like 50 people in the class. And that's not an environment that I thrive in at all. I get really easily distracted. I don't feel comfortable like raising my hand to talk. I don't feel like the discussions really go anywhere, because there are so many people trying to jump in with all these like unrelated tangents. And so within the creative writing program at UBC, the classes are much smaller. It's about 14 people per class. And it's workshop based, meaning that the work you do is creating work and like editing the work of others. And that's something that just seems more satisfying to me than lecture or anything like that. And so that's the main reason why I'm studying creative writing, is just because I don't want to be in big classes. I'm not really studying it with any career goal in mind. Like I have done a lot of theater. I have a play on in a month, actually. But
oh wow!
Oh yeah, it's gonna be fun. I mean, if you end up in Vancouver in a month, which I guess is unlikely, you can come see it. But
tell us what it's about. What's the title? What is
oh the play is called
premise?
Saturdays for the Boys. It's a short play, and it's about a group of online hockey fans. There are four of them. They've been friends in this group chat for 4 years, and they're meeting up for the first time in real life before the Stanley Cup. So that's the basic premise.
Rachel, you are getting a play mounted at 20. That's yeah. Insane.
Yeah. That's so amazing. I don't really have any career goals in theater, because it's even more unstable than online journalism. I always just figured I would graduate university and then go work at a knitting store and just write on the side. so my plans are not particularly fixed.
Well, let me say this. Nothing is stable these days. Obviously, some things are more stable than others, but we can't all be STEM people. And so that's a problem. If you're not inclined to be, say, an electrical engineer or a computer programmer, which neither of us is, as far as I can tell, then okay, you're stuck with doing what you love. Oh, too bad. But I knew from the time I was about 7 years old that I was going to write in some way in my life. And baseball is just the way that I happened to end up doing it, through a variety of mishaps and accidents. And that's where the opportunities were. But I knew that that was what I was going to do, except for one period in my life. And that was when I first got into college. People around me who I trusted were saying, yeah, you're good at it, but you'll never get paid. You'll never make a living. You'll never make money. And you know, for this brief, I would say like a year, year and a half, I listened and I was like, okay, I'll go to law school. And it was only on the very precipice of actually applying to law schools that I said, wait, no. That is not who I am. And then began pursuing this career of mine, which has not been stable. In some years, it's been stupidly lucrative, and not to brag. And because in other years, it has been stupidly unlucrative. And I'm not sure which outnumbers which. And I'd probably be embarrassed to admit that it's the latter. It can be really financially rewarding, and it can be really hand to mouth. But ultimately, if you have the ability, and I feel like you do, just based on what I've read. I mean, I don't know if that means you're going to be able to get a play mounted on Broadway, because you know, you could have incredible ability and still not have that happen. But in the end, you have to kind of do what you love.
Mm-hmm. I've tweeted this story before, but one of the times I was in the hospital, I was obviously feeling absolutely like in the ground awful, like ready to die. I was talking to this psychiatrist and she asked me what I wanted to do with my life. And I was like, I would like to write or do music. Those are the two things that I enjoy. And she's like, okay, sure, but what are you going to do with your brain? And so that's the main thing that I've had people say to me, is that they have believed that I am in some way too intelligent to be wasting my time on this trivial stuff that's never going to make money. And I just don't.
As opposed to what?
Yeah, I don't know. So I just, like, I don't really care at this point. I'm going to keep writing. I don't really care if I ever make a big career of it. Like, I can go get a job and do at the knitting store is always my backup plan.
You're very into knitting. I know you wrote one story about how that's an additional way that you keep yourself occupied while watching ball games. I don't know if the knitting is making a comeback among millennials, or that's just kind of an old fashioned habit on your part. To me, it seems old fashioned, but the hat looked cool anyway, the one that you put in the story.
Oh yeah, no, knitting is definitely making a comeback in my generation. Like, I'm knitting right now, actually, but I'm knitting all the time in class, and people always come up to me and they're like, oh my God, that's so cool. I want to learn how to do that. And it's so easy now to teach yourself. Like, you don't even have to go to somebody and ask them, because you can just go on YouTube. Like, that's how I taught myself 2 years ago. It's a good thing to do if you're easily distracted, as I am. It actually really helps you focus.
Well, it reminded me of, somebody gave me these as a gift many years ago, Greek worry beads, which are kind of supposed to be like an alternative to nervous smoking. They're just these little metal beads that you're supposed to fumble with in your fingers. But it seems to me that if you need that kind of distraction from anxiety or nervousness or whatever, you might as well have a sweater when you're done.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why knitting is so great. I was somebody who fidgeted all the time. I drew random doodles all over all my papers for school from a very young age. I got in trouble for it. I would just write random stuff all over it. But now I can devote that nervous energy into having a lot of cool garments and gifts for people that they are really impressed by.
You've also alluded to writing a novel. Is that still an ongoing thing?
I don't really like writing prose, which is why it's kind of odd to me that I've done so much of like weird fiction for short relief, because I really don't enjoy writing prose most of the time. So I don't know. Maybe it'll get finished. Maybe it won't. I don't know if I'll ever have the motivation to really finish something that long with that many words.
It's something I've done a few times, to the world's great indifference. There is a great feeling of accomplishment when you are done and you can look back at a document of 80,000 or 100,000 or more words, I wouldn't encourage you to go in a War and Peace direction because it's very hard to get something that bulky published. But if you have the voice and you have the ideas, there's nothing, you know, inherently limiting about it. It's just, I think that people psych themselves out over the length. But as with many things, if you look at it as an incremental thing where you're going to do 1,000 words here and 1,000 words there, and then suddenly it's accumulated into this whole thing, it becomes much easier to bite off. And particularly, and I'm sure you know this as a writer, the words start coming through you. If the characters start acting for you, and then it becomes a process of sitting down and almost trancing out. And when you're done, you look up and you say, oh, wow, there are 2,000 more words on the page. And I wasn't really here for a lot of it. I don't remember doing it. It's just there.
Yeah, I think if I ever end up finishing a novel, it's going to have to be after I'm done with school, because I spend so much of my time editing other people's work for my workshop program. And then because you have to concentrate in 3 different genres, I can't really spend that much time like working on one thing. And then on top of that, I have my really long commute. And then on top of that, I have all the baseball writing I'm doing. So my life has been pretty busy for the past like semester or so since I started having more baseball writing to doing. And I started this like really demanding academic program, which is kind of a bummer. Like, I wish I could spend more time writing stuff that I love writing instead of, you know, writing critiques for other people's stuff. But once I'm done, I guess I might look back and be like, oh, that was a really valuable experience learning how to edit, learning how other people form ideas and gaining from that as a writer.
You took the words right out of my mouth, because you do learn sometimes other people's good tricks, and then you learn what not to do. And again, editing is a skill too, and it's a great feeling to make other people better. And so that's yet another potential career outlet for you that utilizes these skills that you so obviously possess.
Yeah, I've thought of editing before. I mean, the volume of editing I have to do right now makes it seem kind of a really unpleasant task that I want to like avoid or get done as soon as possible. But yeah, I mean, I'm 20. I don't know what I'm going to do. Nobody knows what I'm going to do.
I'm not trying to put any pressure on you. I'm just spitballing with you. I wanted to ask about one other thing that you wrote as we get towards the end of our time here together. You wrote that an unsuccessful postseason renders those feelings immaterial. Even if your team had a great season, an unsuccessful postseason renders those feelings immaterial. It's as if you said the regular season didn't happen. Do you really feel that way? Because I feel like in your other stuff, the journey is so valuable, the regularity of the season, the 162 games, and it shocked me that you would be so goal-oriented at the end of it.
I don't feel that way most of the time. I know a lot of other people feel that way. When I'm like in the heat of watching a postseason game, like when the Jays lost in 2015, I was really mad. Last year was kind of a more, not last year, 2016 was more of a zen feeling about it. Like, this was going to happen. They were going to lose to Cleveland. But in that moment, I think it kind of, when you're so zoned in on the happenings of the postseason game and the horror of your team is losing and baseball is going to be over, I think in that moment, like all the feelings that you built up over the season, all the positive feelings, all the negative feelings, they kind of like dissipate and lift up in favor of this really intense feeling about what is happening on the field at that moment. Ultimately, championships and playoff success are not that important to me as a fan.
They're also really fleeting.
Yeah, yeah. But other people do feel that way. And like, that's valid.
It's kind of a hard thing to be as a Blue Jays fan, given that they haven't won anything in 25 years.
Yeah.
Forgive me for saying
so. Well, I mean, I have the dual influence of like a Blue Jays fan and a Yankees fan. So I've got these kind of 2 competing influences on how one enjoys baseball.
So since the offseason has been kind of slow and baseball is one of the ways that you kind of keep yourself in balance, has this offseason been especially trying for you in a personal way?
Yes, absolutely. because usually I would be, you know, as one does, you go on MLB trade rumors, you look at all of the transactions that are happening, you talk about them, you read the analysis. There hasn't really been a lot of that other than people analyzing how it's all going wrong, which is not a fun thing to read about if you have any level of like emotional investment. And also, I'm somebody who thrives kind of on things being structured. Like I really need to put structures in place for myself to avoid kind of drifting off into this nebulous depression yep. space. And so usually there's a kind of rhythm to the off season that unfolds. Like there are these events like, you know, winter meetings, or you can track the progression of various things unfolding. This off season was not like that at all. This may have been coincidental because I was also like really stressed out and sleeping at 7 a.m. But I did feel really bad for most of this winter. But now it's February. The sun is coming out. I have less school to do. So things should be okay from here on out.
So at the risk of, I don't want to put a negative spin on anything that's happening with the Blue Jays, but it seems like this is really kind of a turning point season because it's a team that's aging in a lot of ways. And a couple of key players, namely Josh Donaldson, who's kind of the face of the franchise right now, and J.A. Happ are going to be free agents after. I don't think that there's a lot of anticipation that they're going to re-sign Donaldson in particular, although who knows the way things are going right now. And then on the flip side of that, they have a rising farm system, particularly because of Bo Bichette, who sounds like a Star Wars character, and
he does.
Vlad Jr., who just look both like they're going to be spectacular players, but even two spectacular players does not a franchise make or a pennant winning team make. So is this going to be a bittersweet year for you? And if particularly Donaldson goes, is that going to be, and I'm not talking about from a point of view of depression or anything, just as a fan, is that going to be a tough thing to deal with?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he actually just said this morning that he hasn't had any talks with the Jays about an extension and that he expects to hit free agency. So that's a reality that is coming upon us. And if the Jays are not good in the beginning of the season, like for the first half, I think we can expect a trade probably. And that's going to be tough. Like, I don't think anybody really expects the Jays to be that good this year. But there's also this sense of departure, like impending departure, like something really is ending. So, like something was ending last year, too. I wrote about that in my essay for the BP annual. Yeah, no, I think it's a weird in-between state that the franchise is in right now. I think people have a lot of huge hopes for 2019 and beyond with Bo Bichette and Vlad Jr. But then again, you're right. Two of those players does not a franchise make. And also they're both 18, 19 right now.
Right.
Who knows what could happen in the next few years. So I just hope that hope that people are building for the future, like we're looking beyond this year in a sense to say, okay, we've got this, we're going to have this core in the future. It doesn't end up being frustrated in the end, because I think if those expectations don't pan out, people are going to be very crushed and really feel like this season in particular was just a sad waste.
Well, particularly, I think as controversial as Jose Bautista can be for other towns and other teams, he was very well regarded by the home fans. And even if he had reached the point where he could no longer be the player that he was, I'm sure it was really hard to see him go.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That was a sad day. One wishes that he hadn't had such a terrible season. Like one wishes that he could have gone out on a high note, but that's just not the way it worked out. And then the whole deal with Edwin Encarnacion in the off season before that,
right,
was also something that really left a bad taste in a lot of fans' mouths.
As it should have, because they misread the market and then they signed a guy in Kendrys Morales for too much money who was vastly a lesser hitter skills-wise. So it was like they made a mistake and then they doubled down on it. I mean, I'm not there and that's hard to watch.
Yeah, and it was hard to watch too because Encarnacion really genuinely seemed like he wanted to re-sign with the Blue Jays. Sportsnet did this interview with him the first game he came back as part of the Cleveland's team. And it was really like emotional, like he was shedding tears because he was one of those players like Bautista who had been kind of a scrub player and then exploded into their full potential while with the Blue Jays and had these amazing playoff moments with them. And so that was another like really negative thing about last season, actually. Last season really felt like something special was kind of falling apart and coming to a kind of splat ending, like not with a bang, but a whimper, really.
Which I think is also T.S. Eliot or something like that. I think you would appreciate this, though, or I think are probably already in a position to appreciate this. It's true of both Bautista and with Donaldson, too, who in a way is a tough decision, would be for almost any team, because he's going to be 32 this year. Mm-hmm. And so he goes to free agency, and now you're looking at signing him, depending on how many years, for age 33, 34, 35, and so on. You're definitely, I mean, there's no doubt about it, buying into decline years. And as great as he is, as beloved as he is, if the Jays are not treating themselves as a big market team, which they haven't in many years, to pay him what his production and fielding are worth and then have him disappoint would be really crippling for the franchise. And so as much as he's just this great story, like, mm-hmm. you know, a guy who gets traded by the Cubs and, you know, maybe he's a backup catcher. And then at 27, he's suddenly an annual MVP guy. I mean, it's a great story. It's an unusual story, but the thing about baseball is it sometimes makes you choose between the player you love and the team you love and whether that team is going to win or not.
Yeah. I mean, I feel this way about Troy Tulowitzki because he was injured for half of last season. He was awful before he got injured. He was not all that good in 2016, like he was okay. And in 2015, he was also okay. And now the news comes out that he's injured again. And he's got this huge contract that's going to be weighing down the Jays for the next couple of years. So it is really kind of like, okay, great. My favorite player is on my team, but also he is a burden to the team. And there's not much expectation that he's going to get much better as he's getting older. He's never really recovered from the hip surgery, like he's never really recovered the production. So I don't really want to see the same kind of thing happening with Donaldson. I think me personally, I would be okay with letting him go. It would hurt, but I think it would be fine. The Jays have been having to deal with that a lot lately. There's actually been a lot of frustration with Rogers, who owns the Blue Jays, the big corporation, for not putting more money into the team. Like that's something that's consistently been a complaint among Blue Jays fans. And I think a lot of people are going to be like, if Donaldson doesn't either get extended or if he doesn't get re-signed in free agency, people are going to be like, ah, cheap Rogers. But I think there are definitely reasons not to buy into that. If you really believe in the young team that's supposed to be coming up within the next few years, through the minor league system.
I agree with you absolutely. And regarding Tulowitzki, I lived through that. I feel like I say this once a show somehow. I lived through that with Don Mattingly, who, when he first came up, was briefly, if not the best player in baseball for a few years, was one of the best and could do virtually anything and then develop back problems and played for another 5-6 years and just wasn't remotely the same guy. So when my initial fandom was hung on him, and then I went through, I don't know, those last 2,500 plate appearances with him, thinking in everyone, oh, this is the one where he'll be the old Don Mattingly. Okay, not that one. That was a ground out to shortstop. This next one, he will be the old Don Mattingly. And it just never really happened. There were maybe a few moments here and there that he showed the old form, but he physically couldn't do it, starting at a relatively young age for a ball player. And Tulowitzki is very much the same way, because this was a guy who looked like he was about a third of the way to the Hall of Fame at the point that the Blue Jays acquired him.
Yeah, I mean, every season, I have read a bunch of pieces like, is this the year Troy Tulowitzki bounces back? Is Troy Tulowitzki poised for a bounce back season? And then he gets injured and it never happens. So it feels like you're caught in this constant loop of like bare, like a little bit of hope just being absolutely snuffed out immediately almost. And every year it just gets worse. Like it seems like he's injured more and more every single year. It is really sad. sad. It's sad to see.
It's become a cliche, the F. Scott Fitzgerald line, there are no second acts in American lives. And it's not even true. It's just there were no second acts in F. Scott Fitzgerald's life. Excuse me. There are many other people who've had second acts. But injured ball players in their 30s, they do not get second acts. So it's worth remembering that. Rachel, I want to thank you very much for doing this. I greatly enjoyed this conversation and getting to know you. And again, I've become a convert to your work, and I really love the kind of stuff that you do and that BP is allowing you to do it. I wish you the best of luck with the play. I'm so amazed at that. And I look forward to reading what you're going to do next.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this.
By the twitching of Reggie the Reluctant Lemming's drowning averse whiskers, we've made it to the end of another show. You can follow Rachel McDaniel on Twitter at RumHamlet. That's like rum, the drink, and Hamlet, the play. These are references to drama both high and low, but I'll let her explain that to you some other time. As for me, you can follow me at Go Stephen Goldman. Why Go Stephen Goldman? Because go to the store and pick up some bananas and aspirin, Stephen Goldman, seems incompatible with the high-flying, jet-setting celebrity lifestyle I like to portray. And, of course, you can write us, by which I mean me, at infiniteinning@gmail.com. I've even managed to respond to some on a timely basis lately, so keep them coming. Also, please rate us, at the podcatcher of your choice, iTunes, Stitcher, what have you. It helps keep the show's profile up, and it's the best way you can express your liking for the show. We have a sponsor now, but nevertheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 2. Our producer is Sister Genevieve St. Sebastian. Our theme song, which you are listening to now and have in fact been listening to throughout the episode, is called The Infinite Man, and it was a co-composition of myself and Dr. Rick Mooring. Having listened to last week's episode, Rick informs me that he hasn't played as much tennis lately as he used to, so any of you planning on challenging him to a match should temper your expectations accordingly. Well, if Gubu the cottage cheese-faced god doesn't have a tantrum and causes ear curds to flood the meadow, causing Eleanor the lactose-intolerant cow to have an identity crisis, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.